Sean Spicer served as the 28th White House press secretary and as White House communications director under President Donald Trump. He held that post for about 6 months. He joins us this morning to discuss his new book, The Briefing: Politics, the Press, and the President. Spicer reveals the truth behind some of the biggest news stories of his time in the post, and he offers a glimpse into what it's like to stand at the press secretary's podium and how he got there. The Briefing is the first insider account written by someone who worked on the Trump campaign, with the Trump transition team, and in the Trump White House. It is a pleasure to welcome Sean Spicer to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I guess it seems inevitable when you leave a job like yours that you're going to write about it eventually.
Yeah, it's a good question. When I left the White House, I had no intention of writing a book. In fact, I had demurred on it, and some of the folks close to me said, look, it's too much time. There's a lot of demand for events and organizations that want you there, and you know, you'd have to give up a lot of that. What I found, though, in the first couple months was that the same questions were coming up, the same assumptions about things that had happened. And I kind of realized that if I don't actually sit down and write it, then it's going to be left to others to tell my story. So At the beginning of December, called back up my agent and said, if there's still interest, let's sit down. He said, we're going to have to do it quick. We sat down with a number of publishers and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to talk about who I am as a person, my career trajectory, my values, what happened, but also what happened on some of those pivotal moments over the last 2 years, whether it was the primaries, the convention, the campaign, the transition, or the first few months of the White House, to give people an idea and a perspective as to what was going on behind the scenes.
It seems as though, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but were there publishers who said, oh, we'll publish it, but we want dirt. We would like it to have a negative tone and not exactly as you just described what your intention for the book was.
Yeah, that's a great question. I met with about 12 publishers and I put them in three different buckets. There were four that said, we just don't know that there's anything here. Pretty much straight out after a conversation. There were four that basically said what you're suggesting, that said, if you're willing to lean into a few stories about the following people or to say the certain things, we're interested. And then there were four that basically said, we're interested in what you have. The one I ultimately went with, Regnery, said, we love it, we like this idea, and we're for it. And it fulfilled exactly what I wanted in the sense that they never once made an editorial ask of me in any way to either take something in or add something.
When it comes to that idea of, as you say, leaning in on somebody or to tell a story, is that because you didn't have any or because that's not the type of guy that you are?
The latter. That's not who I am. It's not. I don't think that you can be in a position of trust or in a relationship, frankly. If you think about like a personal relationship, a friendship, a family relationship, if people think that anytime they confide in you or they discuss something with you, that you're going to blab it to everybody, whether it's writing a book or posting it to Facebook, they're not going to trust you. So there was plenty to tell, I guess, in terms of things that happened. But I felt as though what I wanted to do was tell my story about who I was and really let people understand some of the things that were going on behind the scenes. I don't look at this as an opportunity to dish on other people except myself. And I think it's for those folks who have read it, objectively can say, I don't necessarily agree with any conclusion, but which isn't the goal. I'm not trying to convince anyone as much to explain what happened behind the scenes.
So I have read it, and you do exactly that. You explain what it is to go behind the scenes. You explain how you got to this incredible position. I assume a position you never thought in a million years you would get to.
A million plus. Look, I grew up a working class kid in Rhode Island. My parents weren't political. We didn't have any connections. So my only goal was to move to Washington and get a job on Capitol Hill. I got that early on. And then thought I would move home at some point. And I just kept getting more and more passionate about the work that I was doing. Even when I was at the RNC, that's not a trajectory that a White House press secretary in either party normally ends up with. So I didn't really think about that as ever being a possibility.
You write about this fairly extensively in the book about the primary process. Watching it from the RNC catbird seat, could you believe what you were seeing? I mean, you had all of those candidates, and we had to split them up, had two separate debates, you had so many candidates. Could you believe what we were seeing?
No, because when it's like any industry, when you sit and you've looked at it for a long time, I've been in politics over 20 years, you look at how it's supposed to be, how it traditionally goes, the elements that go into a campaign in terms of the number of people that you have out there, volunteers and paid staff going door to door, making voter contact, the data operation that you have, the fundraising operation that you have, all of those key ingredients go into what has traditionally been a successful campaign. And Donald Trump had none of them. He had, you know, a handful of people and a Twitter account, and that just has never been a model that's ever been successful, probably at any level, never mind running for the nomination of a major party for president. So this idea that you could objectively look at that and say that this is somehow going to work, I think for anyone who's been in politics, doesn't make sense.
When did you become a believer that it could work?
Probably January, February of 2016, after Iowa and New Hampshire, we started to realize that these crowds were materializing into people who would actually go to a poll. That's what matters. You can talk about the number of people that show up at a rally, the number of yard signs that you have, the number of likes on a Facebook post. But at the end of the day, elections are won and lost by the number of people who cast a ballot in some way, shape, or form. And you realize that this was real. People were really going out, not just waiting in line for a rally. They were going to go out and vote for Donald Trump. And they were not just voting for him, but if you think about it, and you alluded to this a minute ago, you had these other 16 candidates that had run for office. They had been successful governors, successful members of Congress or senators, and you realized that he was besting all of them, and there was no real effort that seemed to be able to outdo that.
Was there a concern amongst those in the RNC, the Republican National Committee, as you were watching this, that, okay, this may work right now, but what's going to happen when we get to the general election? And is this strategy of take no prisoners, is that going to work in a general election?
I guess there's no question that I think there was some concern. Because, again, going back to what I just said, you saw this operation where throughout all of history, not just, you know, definitely in modern history, you had seen an apparatus that had been used by candidates on both sides to propel them to victory or even to stay in the race tight. And Trump didn't seem to embrace that. He didn't have a research operation. He wasn't raising money. And you have to ask yourself, okay, how, and it's almost, if you think about where we are right now in the economy and so many things, whether it's Uber or Airbnb, I mean, there are so many times when someone probably initially throws this idea and you go, well, that you can't, that just won't work. I mean, that's not how we operate as a society. And it took somebody to break the mold, and Trump broke the mold on how political campaigns could run.
It seems to me this way, I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but even now, even a year and a half in, there are still people who look at this and look at the news cycle that we have and the way the president runs the office and the way that it's being reacted to, where you wonder, is this sustainable?
Right. I think that's accurate. There are people who still wonder that, as if someday it's going to wake up and he's going to say, okay, let's go back to traditional means of doing things. No more tweeting. Here's the, we're going to hew to traditional procedures and methods and protocols. Look, it's not going to happen. The guy's 72 years old. He's set in his ways. He knows what he's going to do. And that's what makes him who he is. He's not somehow going to revert to the old school traditional way of operating and becoming president. He is schooled in a certain management style that he appreciates and finds effective, and he's going to continue it.
So was there a point, and it would just seem to me, I'm just putting myself in your shoes. We're both Irish Catholic kids. So let's say I'm putting myself in your shoes.
Your shoes are a bit bigger, though.
I mean, much bigger shoes. So I would just think there would be times where I would wake up and I would read the tweet of the day and say, oh, God.
Initially, yeah, that was kind of going, because, again, I've been schooled in, you know, if you want to achieve a goal, you craft a message, you build a strategy around that, and then you execute it using a variety of tactics that seem to further the effect that you want, right? That's how it's always been done. What I learned, though, and it took a little while to get used to this, was as a spokesperson, your goal is to articulate the thoughts and views and feelings of the person that you serve. Well, if that person's tweeting it out, then it's a lot easier to say, hey, look, he's tweeted about it. This is what he thinks, full stop. You don't need to go into it. I mean, the goal of the reason the press comes, say, what does the president believe on this? What does he think on this? But if he tweets out those thoughts and views, well, then it took a while to get used to just saying, you know what? He's already tweeted about it. That's exactly what he thinks.
Although it seems, just again, from an outsider looking in, it seems that there were times when you were on the podium where you seemed uncomfortable defending what he was saying.
Well, it wasn't so much defending it as much as I think the press wanted me to explain it or expand on it or to defend it. And that's not the job, as I see it, as a press person. If the president or any principal has spoken in some way about a subject, I think what happened is the press sometimes didn't like what or how he said something and thought it was incumbent upon me. And you see that now still with Sarah, where people will say, but what do you believe? Well, that's not your job. Your job is not to go out there and talk about your feelings and your beliefs. If that were the case, you wouldn't be the spokesperson for somebody else.
So when a reporter, let's just say something that happened yesterday, a reporter stood up and said, can you guarantee that there is no tape or there is no recording where the president said the N-word? Sarah said, I can't guarantee that, but I can't guarantee anything.
Correct.
I don't know about that as a question. It seems on a media standpoint, look, I'm in the media, so I get why you would ask the question. I don't know what you would expect in return if you don't know.
Correct. Well, not just that. But look, Sarah has been with the president for a year and a half, maybe two at the most. I mean, in terms of if you go back to the campaign, I can't remember when she exactly met him. To suggest somehow that she knows what she could guarantee that he has or has not said or done something in his 72 years on earth is absurd. So I think the question was ridiculous. And I say this because you can know somebody really well. You could be married to somebody and they could say, can you guarantee that they've never said or done X? And the idea that anybody can do that, it was a gotcha question. Because the idea is to suggest somehow that Sarah, who's known him for, let's call it 3 years just for fun. So that means for 69 years that she didn't know this president, she's supposed to be able to guarantee. If the question were, can you guarantee that you've never heard this or that you have no evidence of it, I think she could answer and say, yes, I've never heard, I've not seen anything that would substantiate that. I can guarantee that I don't have anything that suggests that that's true. That's a fair question. But to ask someone who's been around somebody for 3 years at most whether they can guarantee something that's happened over a 72-year span is basically a joke. And you saw exactly where it went afterwards. I talk about this in the book. There is this gotcha mentality. That wasn't a real question. That wasn't a question to attempt to get a headline out of it. And exactly what the intention was is what played out. It said, White House can't guarantee. Well, who could guarantee? Anyone except the person themselves.
In the book, you write a lot about the media, and you say that you say there's a lot of good reporters, and there's a lot of reporters that have that gotcha mentality, and reporters that you have concerns of where their allegiances lie. I certainly understand that, and God knows I don't disagree with that. My question to you is, though, when you look at, because you write about this a lot in the book, about the story should be, but instead, let me ask it this way. Should we be talking about Omarosa today?
No. And the irony is that the same press that months ago treated her as a sideshow and said that she doesn't have the credibility to appear on our shows and that she's not in the loop and that she's contradictory on so many fronts now embraces her as this standard bearer for what should be the thing. Only because, let's be clear, if she had written a book that said that I enjoyed my experience with the president, he's done all these great things, not one of these outlets would be talking to her because they would continue to believe she's a sideshow. But because she's criticizing Trump, they want to have her on.
So why doesn't the president just ignore that? It seemed.
I wish he had. I mean, I actually don't believe that she. But I understand. Look, I understand it. If you're under attack, the instinct is to fight back, and he's somebody who believes in that as a tactic to not sit back and let somebody attack you. I get that. If it were me, I'd say she's beneath me.
But it has an effect on the message of the White House. I mean, if you want to be talking about the economy, if you want to be talking about the president's impact on the judiciary, right. If you want to be talking about those issues, and instead the three tweets this morning are about that Omarosa's a dog, well, that diverts the attention not only of the press, but of the American people.
Fair enough. And I mean, I look at yesterday's press briefing where they brought in the director of the POW-MIA task force to talk about the remains that had come back from North Korea and what this was doing to the families who had lost service members. And that's nowhere to be found in the news dialogue, right? It's now about Omarosa, as opposed to talking about, frankly, this amazing feat of bringing back the remains of these soldiers who served our country. We're talking about Omarosa. I agree, but let's remember where it started, right? So the president is reacting to the media coverage of what she's getting. So it's this vicious circle. But let's be clear. It started because she was treated as this prominent person as opposed to the sideshow that she really is.
Sean Spicer is our guest. The new book is The Briefing, Politics, the Press, and the President. At the beginning of the book, you talk about your departure. And you print in the book the letter that you sent the president in July of 2017. You say that you had this letter prepared in May. What was going on in May?
It wasn't just May. I mean, it was from January 20th forward. I had recognized that over and over I was becoming the story. If you're a press person, your job is to speak for somebody else, not defend yourself, not find yourself time and time again the story. And I had become the story too often. And I knew, as difficult as it was to acknowledge, that that was becoming a greater and greater difficult place to be, and that the end was going to come sooner rather than later, and that there was one thing that I could do, which was to start to choose the time and place of my departure, as opposed to wait till it sort of crescendoed and I had become the story one last time too often.
You make the point, and I think it's just, we'll make this quick point, but you were never at any point asked to resign or to leave.
No. In fact, in the book, I talk about how the president asked me to stay on. I did not feel, and honest to God, I believe that this was one of those moments that God not only is talking to you, but he's basically yelling and he's saying, "You've asked for the off ramp, brother. Here it is. Take it. Like now." And I thought that the president wanted a clean slate. This was the opportunity to give it to him. And for me to step back and really kind of break away, it was good for me, it was good for him, it was perfect timing.
So you put it very nicely, and you say you too often became the story. But is that because of you in some way, shape, or form not doing your job effectively or properly, or because of the president that you were serving and the way that the American people, the American press corps, were getting used to this new political philosophy and strategy?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, there were times when I created the problem. I can admit that, or I can say, look, I created this situation, or I screwed up, and therefore it's warranted. There were days when it was, frankly, because of how I was articulating or reacting to the president or something. And then there were days, and I write about it in the book, that there were days when I thought that there was ridiculous memes that had been created, sometimes out of whole cloth. I mean, I write that in the book, there is a Twitter account, a parody Twitter account set up that can be rather funny, but that there were stories written about attributing things that I had said or done based on a fake Twitter account, and I was having to react to a fake Twitter account that had somehow suddenly would say, "Oh, sorry, we'll update the story. Apparently, it's not you." But it had too often become about me, even though it was a fake account. And so, again, it was a cabal of a lot of all of those things. So it became, some of the things were self-inflicted, some of them were brought about by the media, some of them were brought about by the issues of the day. But it didn't matter. It was sort of, it was what it was.
Did you ever feel that you were put in a position to lie about something that you knew not to be true?
Well, there were definitely times, and I've had this over my career, where I had to express a belief or feeling that I didn't personally agree with. But again, we have to get back to the point, which is that my job was not to get up there and talk about what I believed or why I wanted something or how I viewed an issue, right or wrong. It was the president believes the following. What happened too often is reporters believe that it was my job to say, the president believes that this is the current da-da-da-da, but I disagree with that. The life of a press secretary does that is probably somewhere between 10 seconds and a minute, because your job isn't to get up there and call balls and strikes and say, "I don't agree with my boss on this." It's to get up there and say, "This is what they believe." The press corps just could not stand. I mean, they were like, "But you don't agree with that." And in some cases, it was probably right. But that's been the case my career. I've spoken for a lot of folks. In some cases, I agree wholeheartedly. Sometimes I don't. And sometimes it's a mixture. But that's not the role you do. As a journalist, there's probably plenty of times when you have covered a story that you're like, "This does not merit a story, or I don't think that we're covering this the way that I think should be done. But your job is to take what your editors believe is a story that should be covered and cover it. And there are probably plenty of times when you say, I'm glad we're covering this, or sometimes when I'm sure over your career you've said, I don't know why we're putting this kind of effort into this ridiculous story or furthering this narrative that I don't think merits it.
Did you ever, I mean, just in the good old-fashioned Catholic guilt category, where you just feel icky about something that you had to do or say?
I don't know that I would use the word icky. There's days when I thought, why are we focusing on this? Or could we should be highlighting something else more than this? Or there were days when I thought to myself, to your point, where we're stooping down when we should be shooting higher.
When you talk about the fact of you know, looking for the off-ramp, and so you hit the off-ramp, you feel at the right time.
Well, you know, hindsight's 20. I think so, in the sense that, you know, who knows what would have happened, whether it was another month or two. I probably could have held on, maybe 3-4, but it would have come at some point, and my guess is that it would have not been in the same manner that I did it, meaning that it's possible the president would have said, okay, I've had enough now. Now you're fired.
You write in the beginning of the book that Anthony Scaramucci had a lot to do with it. It was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. But again, you had been thinking about it for a while, but this restructuring was not for you.
No. In fact, I talk about that ideally I had been dual-hatted. Like, I wasn't just press secretary, I was communications director a couple times in that. And what I thought was that had been where I should have probably spent my effort, pulled in Sarah, made her press secretary earlier. That didn't happen. And I should have focused on making that the ultimate goal sooner rather than later. And that opportunity of him bringing him in and realizing that that situation was going to be untenable was, as you put it, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Final question is that, a lot is being made, and I don't know if it's fair or not. You tell me. You come out and people say, a former press secretary of the White House, the road is paved with gold. You can go wherever you want. You can do whatever you want. Do you find that to be the case?
To some degree. I mean, sure, I've been offered a lot of opportunities. I think if I want to sell out, I think if you look at what I've done since I left, I have a podcast, I have a couple clients that I've been working for. People who are interested can go to SeanSpicer.com and sign up. But I have turned down a lot of money and offers that I don't think are things that I would want to dignify myself with, that I think are unbecoming, that I think are disloyal. And I think that everyone who's read the book, and, you know, the president's tweeted about it, the vice president's tweeted about it, I feel good about it. It's not a tell-all. It's a great understanding of the political process of what's been going on the last couple of years. But I want to be able to walk around with my head held up saying I'm doing things that provide for my family. I've spent 20-something years now, either on a government salary, a military salary, or a campaign salary. So the last year I've been blessed with opportunities to come out and do some different things. But there were a lot of things that I could have done if I left the RNC 5 years ago or, you know, 4 years ago, 2 years ago. And I'm very comfortable with all the decisions that I've made since I've left.
The name of the book, The Briefing, Politics, the Press, and the President. Sean Spicer, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Again, Sean Spicer's book is The Briefing. It is published by Regnery, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.